This is London Calling.
Hi, I'm Graham Mack, and this week, part two of my chat with Mike Brewer. You might know him as the host of the TV show Wheeler Dealers, but he also hosted another show called Frontline Battle Machines.
The pilot of the helicopter that I was travelling in got shot in the face whilst I was sat in the back of it with my cameraman. So, yeah, that's how hairy it got. And I'm sitting in front of somebody who'd lost his leg, screaming for his mother. I've got a dead guy sitting, you know, laying to the next to me. A guy got shot getting in the helicopter. I've got a round that was underneath my butt in the airframe, and there were 10 rounds that went through the cockpit of the helicopter. So if you're in a helicopter with 21 other souls on board, traveling at 220 miles an hour, and hearing on the radio that you're about to be a smear on the desert floor because the pilot's been shot, it's pretty hairy.
More from Mike Brewer later, but first, let's have a look at what's been happening in Britain this week. Let's check in with Ken. You've had an issue in a supermarket.
Yesterday I was in Asda, and I get really, really peed off when people in front of me do their packing, put a thing away, then decide to pay. You know you've got to pay. They don't give it away free. Have your card or your cash ready.
Now,
I find it really annoying.
Was this person a female?
As it happens, yes.
There's something, like, it doesn't matter what the transaction is. Men will have either the card or the cash in their hand when they're at the counter.
Exactly.
Women will order what they want or pick up what they want, and then they'll rummage in their bag to get their purse out. It's like the first thing that men do, it's the last thing that women do. I don't understand it.
And they say women can multitask.
Well, I don't know what it is. Now, it sounds like a sexist comment. The worst one is if you go in a newspaper shop and you're busy and they've got a stack of the local paper right on the counter there and you just want to grab one and give them the exact change and so you can run out and catch your train or whatever. If a lady has been there before you, she has placed her bag on top of that pile of papers,
yep,
and she's rummaging for her. It's like she's moved in. And you know, you're like, hey, come on, I just want to grab and go. It's like, I think we're just more efficient shoppers. We're mission shoppers because we hate shopping. We want it over with as quickly as possible. Women want to drag it out because they actually like this experience. The UK election is being fought over free school meals. Right now, kids in the first 2 years of school in the UK get a free meal at lunchtime. The Conservatives, who are in government right now, say they want to stop funding that if they get back in. Now, that's a good sign. It's the parents' job to make sure their kids are fed, not the state. Don't get me wrong. The state has a duty of care to the most vulnerable in our society, but free school meals should only be given to families who are in genuine need. Giving children food seems an odd thing for a government to be doing, especially when we're told they should be doing more to fight childhood obesity. The irony is that some of the kids who are being fed by our taxes could stand to miss a meal. And just when you think the Conservative Party are on the right track by talking about ending free school meals for all, we find out that they're saying some of the money saved by ending universal free school lunches will be used to give all primary age children a free breakfast. So the only thing that's changing is the time of the day that they get the free food. The biggest problem I have with all of this is the message it sends to British kids. They're being taught that the state will look after them. This will breed a generation with an inbuilt culture of entitlement. Eventually, they'll need to go out into the real world and make their own way in life. A feeling of entitlement will only hold them back. You don't grow by sitting back and letting someone else take care of you. You grow by making your own mistakes. by earning and paying your own way. One of the most important lessons we can teach our children is that in life, there's no such thing as a free lunch. Hey, how's this for a great bargain? A lady in Middlesex this week has discovered that a ring she bought for £10 at a car boot sale could be worth a lot more. She was in a jeweller's and the jeweller said, "Hey, let me have a look at that ring." So she showed him. Now it's being auctioned. They reckon it'll get about £350,000. What's the best bargain you've ever got? Dominic.
Best bargain? Can I say the wife?
Oh, that's nice. What's her name?
Natalie.
Natalie. That is a lovely thing to say. She's a bargain.
Absolute bargain.
Because wives are expensive traditionally.
Absolutely. No, my wife's not. She surprised us with our wedding.
You what?
Yeah, she surprised me with our wedding. I didn't know about it.
You didn't know about your wedding?
No, until the night before. She took me out to dinner.
Yeah.
Gave me an invitation to my own wedding the following day.
How long have you been seeing her?
Oh, crikey, 20-odd years we've been
together. I think it's about time.
Yeah, well, it was coming up to, we're 10 years next April. So 9 years we've been married, but we've been together over 20 years.
Oh, that is a brilliant thing to do.
She did the whole thing for £3,000.
Is that right?
She pulled a blinder.
Did she ever?
I didn't know anything about it. She's the best bargain on the planet, my wife.
All right, thank you.
Meant in, obviously, the loveliest way possible.
Oh, Dominic, that's nice. Brexit has not been good for Britain. The UK inflation rate is the highest it's been in a long time. Figures that came out this week show that inflation rose to 2.7% in April. That's the highest it's been in 3.5 years. Now, I told you this would happen before we voted to leave the EU. I said the value of the pound will go down and that will cause prices to rise. Wages, they're not going up as fast. Wages only went up by 1.9%, so we're all worse off because of Brexit. And we haven't even started the so-called negotiations on leaving the EU yet. And I say so-called negotiations because it'll be nothing like a negotiation. We don't have a bargaining chip. We're already committed to leaving. So we'll pay whatever the EU say we have to pay to get out. It's up to them to decide. There's nothing to negotiate. And they'll make it as painful as possible as a warning to other member states not to be so reckless. The weak post-Brexit referendum pound means airfares have gone up, clothing's more expensive, and so is food. The cost of living in Britain has gone up at its fastest rate in nearly 4 years, much faster than earnings. Now, the economy has grown over the last 2 years because of a surge in consumer spending, but that's been fueled by an increase in credit. So now, not only are we worse off, we're deeper in debt as well. Wait till interest rates start going up. That's inevitable. That's what higher inflation does. The fall in the value of the pound following the Brexit vote has pushed the prices of imports, especially food and clothing, pushed them up. The Bank of England predicted last week that inflation would peak at 2.7% in the summer. Well, that forecast is going to have to be revised, especially after the Office of National Statistics said inflation was already above 3%, meaning that more rises in inflation are expected. Alan Clark, an economist at Scotiabank, says he expects even higher electricity and gas prices. He says they're on their way. And higher food prices. And that will push inflation to 3.25% in the summer. Clark says that the retail price index, which includes some housing costs, is already at 3.5% and will rise to 4.25% by the end of the year. the National Institute for Economic and Social Research, forecast last week that British workers will see their disposable income shrinking this year as a result of rising inflation. Brexit caused a 20% devaluation in the value of the pound. Now it's working its way through the economy, and inflation is eroding wages. No one's happy that in real terms wages have gone down, but you can't complain if you're a Brexiteer, because this is what you voted for. You caused this. I'm reminded of a tweet I saw the day after the referendum results came out. And it's as true now as it was then. It said, if you punch a random stranger today, there's a 52% chance they deserved it. Let's check in with Badger.
Brexit?
Yeah.
Best thing that ever happened to me.
Why?
And my mum.
Why?
Well, we've got offshore investments, yeah?
Yeah.
And, of course, they've gone massively up.
Because the pound has fallen.
We've got loads of money.
And there's no tax on it. There's no tax on it either.
Yeah. We've got loads of money. It's excellent.
Oh, brilliant.
Can't be any better. Keep it going.
So, well, I got it all wrong, Badger. I take it all back. Brexit's been great. It's been great for Badger.
Yeah, put me down for some of that. Have they got an ulterior Brexit where we can get even more money?
Britain's next general election is only weeks away. I was asked an interesting question at work today. In the middle of a crowded office, the sales manager said to me, which way do you vote? I said, well, it depends. When it comes to politics, I don't have a brand loyalty. I approach picking the party to vote for the same way as I decide which car to buy. I look at my circumstances, I choose the one that suits my lifestyle, then I make a decision. I used to drive a Porsche. It was a 911, Carrera 4S. It was a great car. But as I got older, I realized it was costing me too much money to run. So now I've gone completely the other way. I drive a Japanese hybrid. If my circumstances change, I may go back to Porsche. Until then, I'll stick with the fuel-efficient Jap. It's the same with politics. If a party comes out with a flashy new model and promises how it'll make my life better, I might go that way. But if I do, and then I realise it was all hype, or it's starting to cost me a lot more, I'll go a different way next time. And I think that's the most sensible way to look at politicians. Give them the same level of respect that you give to a used car salesman. Let's talk to Jim via Skype from Philadelphia. And Jim, you've sent me some clips of your mum doing stand-up comedy. In her 60s, she decided to have a bash at this. This audio is from a contest she entered at a local club, and she won. What's her name?
Dot Kennedy. There's nothing on the internet about her now.
But Dot Kennedy is one to watch.
Yeah.
So what's the name of the comedy club?
Helium.
Helium. So it's your mum live at Helium, and she came first out of how many?
It was 13, 14. And it was basically, it's a guy named Brad Trackman.
Yeah.
Runs I forget what he calls it, a stand-up academy or something.
A workshop or something, yeah. Yeah.
So he does classes all year long.
Yeah.
Based out of this, out of Helium Comedy Club.
Yeah.
And then twice a year
he had literally,
this.
not done any stand-up until she was over 60.
It was her 60th birthday that we gave. My brother's idea was to give her these stand-up lessons.
And look where this has led. That's an Oprah or Ellen DeGeneres show there, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's to be 60 and wanting to get into stand-up. No one does that.
Or she's a late-night talk show guest, not just doing a spot, but panel as well.
It's crazy. My mother's crazy.
Welcome to the stage, Dot Kennedy!
All right. I know some of you were wondering, why is this chubby old white chick here doing stand-up with these young guys? It's simple. Somebody's got to ride Betty White's coattail. Besides, I figure at this point, sleeping my way to the top is pretty much out of the question. Unless, of course, they're really talking about sleeping. In which case, I am at the top of my game. I could lie right down here on the stage and be in a coma in 5 minutes. That's coma, as in, tell the Undertaker, no need for embalming. I waited till I was older to start experimenting with drugs. Sometimes I take my blood pressure pill in the morning. Sometimes I take it at night. Now that I'm the one taking drugs, my kids are all over me, telling me they're gateway drugs. They're only going to lead to the hard stuff. Yeah. Like today, I'm lowering my cholesterol. Tomorrow, I'm a crack whore. I'm going to tell you right now, aging does have its challenges. I had to have surgery recently. Had a foot of my intestine removed. It wasn't pleasant, but it could have been worse. A friend of mine got it twisted and started telling people Dot had a foot taken out of her colon. Like somebody put their foot up my ass and it stuck. And think about it, who would they send in after that? A proctologist? A foot doctor? Roto-Rooter? You tell me. I also have osteoporosis, and basically this means my bones are very porous. They're like chalk. Most people are worrying about dropping dead. I gotta worry about crumbling to death. I told my husband, if you have to dial 911 for me, tell the paramedics, forget the defibrillator, just bring a dustbuster. I'm gonna tell you, I'm from New York originally. Whenever I meet another former New Yorker down here, my husband says it sounds like we were all in prison. The conversation always starts, when'd you get out? When'd you get out? I admit to having been a New York snob. I was 3 months pregnant when my husband came home and told me he'd been transferred from Manhattan to Wilmington, Delaware. I said, Wilmington, Delaware, I'll go, but I'm not going till I have the baby. I was not having a baby in the deep south. I didn't think they had hospitals. When we drove south on the Jersey Turnpike and the New York radio stations faded out, we thought we were only gonna hear country western music. People in New York said, Delaware, isn't that the capital of Maryland? It's not a clue, not a clue. Actually, I grew up on a dead-end street in Queens, and summers in the city were the best. Most people, they want to go to the mountains or the shore for vacation, not me. A day in the country, I start going into withdrawal. Not enough cement. I got a very broad education growing up in the city. First of all, I could curse like a sailor by the time I was 12. In 7 languages. Fluently. But I also learned how to be a lady. honest to God, they taught us how to curtsy in kindergarten. And now this was the 50s, and did they think we were going to be meeting royalty growing up on a dead-end street? It made, looking back, it made no sense to me until I realized these are the same people who were telling us to hide under the desk in case of nuclear attack. Thank you very much.
Remember that name, Doc Kennedy. Well, let's get to this week's guest. It's part two of my chat with Mike Brewer. I spoke to him via Skype. He was on a freeway in San Francisco on the way to a shoot for the latest series of Wheeler Dealers. It's a car show where he buys cars, he does them up, and he sells them. So there's a story there, and you don't know how it's going to end. I asked him of all the cars they've featured on the show, which was the best and the worst ending?
Let's go with the worst. Most definitely the worst ending was it's the show that we'd like to call the Lost Program. We would really like it and appreciate if Discovery Channel would find the tape, take it off the shelf and burn it because nobody wants to see it again. We don't want to see it again, but unfortunately they keep repeating it. And it was the Suzuki SJ410. That was very much in the early days of Wheeler Dealers. I'd bought five cars of a run of six. We had one filming day left for me to buy a car, and the production team, not me, said, oh, we know somebody who's got a Suzuki SJ410 for sale, and it's cheap, £500 or whatever it was. And they forced me to go and buy it. I didn't want to buy it. They forced me to go and buy it, and it was a disaster, the car. We never even got it through an MOT, which is almost like a state certificate to get, for its roadworthiness. We never got it through that. It was a disaster. I had to sell it to a farmer's son who could only drive it across a field. It was awful program, awful ending.
I advertised that Mini Monster truck in an off-road magazine, and I had quite a bit of interest. The guy behind me, he's called Phil, and he got down here nice and early because his father's got a bit of land, and he wants something he can have a bit of fun with. So wish me luck as I try to put our Tonka toy to bed. Phil, thanks for coming down. Yeah. I really appreciate it.
Nice.
You like it?
Yeah, it is cracking, quite pretty, isn't it?
It's got a Boggo standard interior. It looks all right, doesn't it?
Well, these are quite a good idea, aren't they?
Yeah, little plastic seat covers. They work. You can get them dirty and muddy and just hose them off. In fact, you can hose off the whole of the inside of this car.
And how many miles has it done?
Well, that's irrelevant, to be honest with you, because it's got a new engine in it.
Right, okay.
So it's got a nice lump, and it all works, and it goes, and it sings, and it does all the right things, yes?
Yeah.
Happy?
That's all right.
Good work. Round the back, we've got this fantastic rollover bar.
And it's welded to the chassis.
It is, yeah. It's bolted right down onto the chassis. It's actually bespoke. It was made for this car, and it's a competition one, and that means in the event that a car ever falls over, this will protect you. It could save your life.
And what about the hood?
Yeah, we've got a hood for it. It's grey. It matches the car. It looks fantastic. Got no holes in it. Now, the actual vehicle, we changed the geometry. To get it to look like this, what we did is we raised the ride height by a whole 8 inches. So it's 8 inches more off the ground, and it's 6 inches wider, and it's emphasised by these big chunky wheel arches. So what do you think?
Well, it's pretty. It looks nice. But it's got a bit of damage at the back there, you know, in the pan. Yeah. It needs some welding done.
Yeah, but that's why it's only £600. If we did the welding and tidied the thing up, it'd be well over £1,000.
Yeah.
I just want to sell it, and I want it to go to a good home, and I want someone to enjoy it and have a bit of fun with it.
Yeah.
And you're just going to have to accept it for what it is, really.
Yeah.
So, £600.
600. I'll give you five.
£500?
Yeah.
Cash?
Yeah, cash, of course, yeah.
I'm never going to say this again, but do you promise not to look after it? Do you promise to it to bits and really have good fun with it?
I'll wreck it all right, yeah.
You will. I'll bet your end. All right, fella, congratulations. Right. You bought a very, very cheap car. Well done.
Thank you very much.
A financial loss, but not a dead loss. The Suzuki was inches from the scrapper, and thanks to us, it's now out there riding high. And I feel pretty good about that, and I'm sure Phil does too.
I think the best has to be the Lamborghini Urarco. That was a car that I found in Poland, locked in a garage for 20 years, stuck in this snow-frosted ice cocoon. And I got the car out of the garage, back to the workshop to Ed, who did an amazing job restoring the car. Remember, it's got mechanical fuel injection. It's a really difficult car to work on. We recommissioned the car back to the road, and the culmination of it was to take the car on an amazing trip with 300 Lamborghinis to Bologna to celebrate Lamborghini's 50th anniversary. And we drove it through the foothills of the Dolomite Mountains on Ed's birthday. So it was a nice birthday present for him. And it was a wonderful thing to do in a lovely car.
Suddenly, we're surrounded by Lambos.
Believe it or not, Ed, there's alleged to be 190,000 brake horsepower here.
Well, I think you'll find it's 190,220, actually.
Yeah, if you include us, that's very true, but the car is going sweet, isn't it?
It is going beautifully. I think this glorious experience is going to last far longer than this parade, actually.
I'm sure it will. Whoever buys this car is going to be one lucky person.
Oh, they sure are.
The parade is heading for Parc Fermé in the centre of Bologna. That's over an hour away and it's starting to get dark. Time to put the hammer down.
Did you ever make mistakes along the way that you regretted later? Like, you know, changing a part that was maybe should have remained original because it might affect its value?
Yeah, you're always going to run into that. We've restored over 135 cars now on Wheeler Dealers. And you're always going to run into a part that you regret doing or something that you regret doing on the car. And I could probably say that about most of those 135 cars. But, you know, it is a TV show and we have a deadline. We have a transmission date. There are, you know, if the show's going out on a Tuesday, it's coming out on Tuesday. And so, and I'll be honest with you, there's been days if the show's going out Tuesday at 9 o'clock, in the UK, Tuesday at 5 o'clock, I've been at the studio trying to sell the car with a biker standing there, sitting on a motorbike, waiting for the tape to come out the camera to go to the edit suite to be cut in to go out 2 hours later on a global transmission. So it's been that tight a deadline before. So sometimes you regret, you know, selling a car too cheaply, letting a car go that you've fallen in love with. But you just have to do it to meet a deadline so the show gets transmitted.
Well, it's a huge success. There's also Wheeler Dealers Trading Up. Where did that idea come from?
From me. So Wheeler Dealers Trading Up is a show that I produced from my own company. I wrote many years ago, and I wanted to show the global, the audience, that you can trade your way up to a new or a very decent, wonderful supercar by just having the guts to go out and do it. And I get hundreds of emails of people around the world to tell me they've been inspired that program and they've done exactly that. I took just $2,000 and I traded my way around the world to a Ferrari with just $2,000. And I proved that you can move cars around the world like you could fine wine or coffee or sugar or gold, that you can play the car market like you can the money market. And you can end up, if you know what you're doing, moving cars out of one marketplace into another marketplace, you can, with a car of your dreams, for very little outlay.
And the first one, you traded up to a Porsche convertible, wasn't it? A 996. What did you start with on that one?
I started with it's a Suzuki A to Z, Atos. That's what is known as in the rest of the world. And that was in India. I bought that car in India. It was started off with $2,000, and I bought that car, I think, for $1,000, and ended up trading in 8 shows to a Porsche 911 convertible that owed me $2,000, including all the shipping.
Yeah. Now, we all know television is a little bit different to real life. Have you ever had to cheat to make a story work?
Never. Not yet. I would say that, you know, the only cheat that you would have on television that makes my job these days slightly easier is I'm very recognizable. So when I turn up to somebody's house to go and buy a car, they know me and they want to sell the car. that if there was any cheat to anything I do, I would say it's that, you know, the fact that when I go to buy a car, they are willing to sell me the car for, you know, because they know who I am, and they're just willing to let it go. And it's also true when I sell the cars, people know the show now, they know who I am, they know what the car's going to be like, it's going to be a great car, so inevitably they're going to just buy it. So if there was any cheat to wheeler dealers, it's that. But there is no cheat, because they are real people. We really do. But I really do. I'm in the car now, driving to a real person to go and buy a real car for a real person. And at the end of the show, I really will advertise the car, and I really will sell it to a genuine real person.
What is the car that you're on the way to have a look at?
I can't tell you that. If I told you that, a red dot would appear on me from Velocity and Discovery Channel, and I'd be taken out if I was. I can tell you a little hint. I'm on my way to go and buy a fiery little Italian.
Okay, we'll take that. Now, in 2010, you presented frontline battle machines. You travelled to the front line in Afghanistan to see what machinery the troops had to work with there. You were already a world-famous TV presenter. Why did you go to such a dangerous place?
Because I'm also a patriot, and I wanted to show what our armed forces have to face and what they go through. And as a UK citizen and a taxpayer, I wanted... as money was going, so I was fed up with hearing stories on the headlines and newspapers about soldiers not having the right equipment on the front line. So I genuinely thought that's got to be rubbish. They must have the right equipment, because I pay a lot of tax, so they must have the right equipment. So I absolutely truthfully, off my own back, I had a day doing nothing, so I walked up to the MOD building in Whitehall, London, and asked to speak to the press officer. They asked who I was, and I blagged it. I said, I'm Mike Brewer from Discovery, a big fan of my shows. So the guy came down and met me. We went in the building, and I said, I just want to ask you, you know, is it true? Do the troops not get supported on the front line? He said, absolutely not. It's a load of rubbish. And I said, well, prove it to me. I want to go out there and meet the troops. I want to do something. You know, I want to do something to show my support. And I'll come back with a better news story for you for one of the newspapers. And ultimately, that grew into what become a fantastic documentary series for Discovery Channel, Frontline Battle Machines, which embedded me on the front line for 3 months, where I nearly lost my life quite a few times. And it's one of the experiences of my life I would never change. You know, I was terrified, but I loved every single minute of doing it, being with those professional soldiers and seeing what they go through. And I see things that human beings never see in their lives. Come back with an amazing documentary series that I'm incredibly proud of.
How hairy did it get then, Mike?
It got hairy enough that the pilot of the helicopter that I was travelling in got shot in the face whilst I was sat in the back of it with my cameraman. So, yeah, that's how hairy it got. And I'm sitting in front of somebody who'd lost his leg screaming for his mother. I've got a dead guy sitting, you know, laying to the next to me. A guy got shot getting in the helicopter. I've got a round that was underneath my butt in the airframe, and there were 10 rounds that went through the cockpit of the helicopter. So if you're in a helicopter with 21 other souls on board, traveling at 220 miles an hour, and hearing on the radio that you're about to be a smear on the desert floor because the pilot's been shot, it's pretty hairy.
Ready, clear off.
That's it, we're airborne, we're away. Minutes, absolute minutes, under a full firefight.
The Chinook's loading bay has indeed proved its worth by aiding quick loading and minimising the aircraft's time on the ground. It's time for the Merc team to deal with the casualties.
Everything worked fantastically. When these guys are under pressure, look at the professionalism, look at them just doing their job.
But we're still under fire. And the helicopter's been hit. And it's not just a helicopter that's taken a bullet. Our pilot's been shot too.
All right, chaps, just to let you know, it took a round through my front windscreen, which came up and hit me on the head. Got a bit of a crack and a bleed there.
With the Chinook struggling to remain airborne, our co-pilot makes an emergency call back to Camp Bastion.
Mayday 673, 9 miles to the south, we've taken a round through the cockpit, and also got some transmission problems. Yeah, I think we've taken round above me.
Not only has the pilot been hit, another bullet has severed a hydraulic pipe, and he's wrestling with the controls of 12 tons of helicopter travelling at 200 kilometres an hour.
Mayday, Tricky 73, Tricky 73, Tricky 73. Contact.
That was one incident, and it very quickly got followed up by another incident where the Taliban chased me for 14 hours across the desert on a combat logistics patrol. And I nearly had a confrontation with an Afghan police officer at a checkpoint, which meant that pistols had to be drawn and we had to calm people down. So I had many incidents while I was out there. Some of them made it to screen, like the helicopter incident and the combat logistics patrol. But some of the other stuff that I see didn't make it to screen because it was just too, it was too hairy, and it's not stuff that should be shown to the audience.
And what did Michelle, your wife, think about all that, putting yourself in so much danger for your art?
Okay, well, Michelle has been the backbone of me, really. And Michelle gives me a full support. She packs my bag, sends me out the door with a kiss, and says, go do it. You know, if this is what you want to do, go do it. And Michelle, we was incredibly worried. We had to sit and make wills, and that was the first time we'd done that. And we really had to think seriously about, you know, what my funeral arrangements were and all of that kind of stuff, and what was to happen if I was to lose my legs on a landmine. And, you know, these are deep, meaningful conversations. But ultimately, Michelle stood, you know, shoulder to shoulder, and I couldn't have done it without her support. And she's incredibly proud that I went and done it. And it was a big moment in my life, particularly as I had a massive career making my car shows, you know, and Discovery Channel were put in their lead host in the world, literally on the front line in a war zone. But if I can't come back and tell that story from a normal guy's point of view, then the show wouldn't work. And that was the point of the program. I wanted to be the guy in the pub who could just tell the story of what was really happening on the front line, and that's exactly what we achieve. And thanks to Discovery, they let me go and do that.
How do you balance family and work life?
These days, I bring my wife with me. So for the last 2 years of making Wheeler Dealers, I've made so many sacrifices to TV over the years. Michelle hadn't seen me really for the last 18 of the 20 years I've been making television. But now our daughter has gone to university. My wife doesn't have to be a housewife anymore, taking my daughter backwards and forwards to school. And that meant my wife can really do what she does best, and that's be my manager. So Michelle is now travelling with me wherever I go. I insist on it, and family is a big part of my life, and I want my wife with me by my side all the time because I've missed her for 18 years, and it's lovely to have her with me, and it actually brings a new dynamic to what I do on a daily basis with the crew and with the banter and with the dynamic that happens. And Michelle does all the social media technical support for me as well. So it's really good having somebody like that with me all the time.
Outside of family, let's talk about friends. It's been said that when you become famous, you don't change, but the people around you do. Have you found that to be true?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've had many friends along the way across the years that only actually want to become my friend because of who I am. And that's kind of sad. You know, people have sucked me dry over the years. I'm not going to name names, but they're listening in, they probably know who they are. And I'm a very open, honest guy. I do embrace people very quickly, and I bring people into my little family very quickly. And that's one of my failings. I'm never going to change. I am that person. So, yeah, I've had people take advantage of me over the years. They still do today. But I've got a very, very tight circle of very close friends who are amazing. I can count them on one hand, like most people can. And they are amazing, you know, and these are the people that I trust my life to. And they'll always be a part of, you know, part of my friendship forever. They know who they are. You know, I'm proud to call them my friends. I really am.
Let's quickly talk about cars then, because we have to. How many do you own?
Well, that's a good question. I've got my wife sitting right behind me. So can we Can I give a very general answer? We own, both me and Michelle, we've got quite a good car collection, actually. We've got a 67 Mustang Fastback, a 68 Camaro SS, a 1972 Citroen SM Maserati, a Porsche 912 from 1976, a 1927 Model T, a 1960 Bedford CA van. Michelle recently bought a 1958 Fiat 500 Nuovo. And I think we've just bought another Fiat 500 Nuovo to go with it, its sister car. And we may have a few others. but we've got quite a nice collection of cars.
What's your favourite?
Our cars are really important to us. Well, they're really important to us because they're not for us. You know, we buy these cars to share.
Yeah.
So we give our cars up to charity events and to events for where people can raise money by going for drives in them and enjoying them. And these are not, you know, trinkets that we put behind a glass box. They're out there to be used. Me and Michelle are patrons of several charities in the UK. We do a lot for the car industry. I'm the president of the Coventry Transport Museum as well.
That Coventry Museum, that is a terrific museum, and it's free as well.
It's a free transport museum. I'm the president of that museum. I'm incredibly honoured to be the president of the Coventry Transport Museum, and I've put a lot of effort into to getting good awareness for Coventry Transport Museum and driving people to it, getting people to go and visit. It's just gone through an £8 million refit, and it's absolutely incredible. And recently I was announced the patron of Seesaw, an amazing Oxfordshire charity, together with my wife, where we've raised, you know, lots of money for these people in the past, and they've now made me the patron of that. It's a great... we've had some cancer deaths in... Personally, I lost one of my brothers, and Michelle lost her mother very recently, and we've done a lot in terms of counselling and bereavement support for people that have lost friends and family through cancer, and that's drawn us to a charity called Seesaw, where we've become patrons recently.
And do you have a favourite car, mate?
A favourite car, yes. I think that out of my collection, I have love affairs with my cars. At the moment, you know, I've had my little Fraulein in the garage, my little Porsche 912 at home, and I've used that on a daily basis. I love that car. But I just recently had a little cheat on the side with my little French fancy with its Italian heart, my Citroen Maserati, my SM, and I've had like a little fling on the side, but I can't tend to let go of my wonderful beast of an American, my 67 Mustang Fastback that's sitting in our dealership in Sheffield. I can't seem to let go, and every time I see that car, I fall back in love with it again. So as you can see, I sort of love all my cars, and that's why they're in our collection. But at the moment, I suppose my love affair is with my little French fancy, my Citroen Maserati.
What's the worst car you've ever owned?
Oh, blimey. I've owned quite a few bad cars in my time. I have. I suppose, you know, cars are just frustrating. They can be little angry things, cars, and they can fight you at every step of the way. And I don't know, really. That's a big question because there's been too many of them. That's the answer.
Okay, if someone's buying a used car, what's the most important things to look out for to make sure they're not buying a lemon?
Well, the most important thing is who the person is that you're buying a car from. Are you buying the car from somebody that, you know, looks like they've raced and rallied it over the years? Or are you buying a car from somebody who looks like he's, you know, smoking a pipe, got leather gloves on, a flat cap and polished it every weekend? What you're looking for in a car is honesty. You're just looking to buy a car that's straight, honest and being really well cared for. Don't buy a car that's, you know, belong to a stunt driver. Simple as that, really. It can't be any more obvious. These days there are a lot of tools and weapons out there to you can use at your disposal, YouTube videos, or you can use one of the big car companies like the AA, the RAC or the AAA to send somebody out to do an inspection on a car for you to make sure the car is in really good order. And it's worth it, you know, for the price of a tank of fuel. It's worth it to make sure that the car's exactly what you want.
If someone's looking to restore a car for profit, which one would be one that you'd recommend that would be a good one to start with?
A good one to start with these days would be a Triumph Spitfire. That's a really good starter classic that are on the up. We've just arrived at location. So a good car would be a Triumph Spitfire.
3 minutes up the road.
No worries.
Okay, well, I realise you're busy, Mike. I'll wind this up. When can we see the next season of Wheeler Dealers?
Wheeler Dealers will be on the screen on Velocity Channel in the US and Discovery Channel globally, starting from the fall this year, so autumn this year, around September, October time.
What's next for Mike Brewer?
Next for Mike Brewer is more filming Wheeler Dealers. I've got 16 more shows to make. I'll be appearing at MG Live in the UK at Silverstone in June. I'll also be at Silverstone in the UK again in July for the Silverstone Classic. We have the Used Car Awards presentation in London at the end of the year, which is a big awards presentation that I host as well. So a full-on year, more cars, more shows, more live events, and we're very excited.
How do we keep up with you and get more information, Mike?
If you want to keep up with me, you can follow me on Twitter at Mike Brewer for the backroom gossip of Wheeler Dealers and some of the more day-to-day stuff. You can follow my wife, which is at Mrs. M. Brewer. And you can find me on Facebook at Wheeler Dealer. That's me. And on Instagram at Mike Brewer as well. So, you know, we've got quite a big social media following. So it's nice to talk to people. It's me that does it. I don't have a team of people. It's me personally that will answer you or my wife.
Mike Brewer, thank you so much for your time. You fitted me into your busy schedule. I really do appreciate that. Best of luck with everything you do. You're a genuine bloke, and I just wish nothing more than more and more success for you and the show. Thanks once again, Mike Brewer.
And you, Graham. Thanks, buddy. See you later. Bye-bye.
Well, that's it for this week. No show next week because I'll be in New York City. I'm going to be at the Talkers Radio Conference. And you'll find out all about how I got on when I get back. Week after next, London Calling. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Graham Mac. If you want to hear more Mac Nuggets, check out my website, macmedia.co.uk, and subscribe to my Bob FM show on iTunes. Got a question or something to say? Send me an email. Put your phone number in the email. I might call you back on the show. I might Skype you if you put your Skype details in there. My email address, graham@macmedia.co.uk. And you spell Graham like the cracker, Mac like the truck. Till next time. Ta-da.